to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. I got to tell you something, people. I was having dinner with Joanne tonight, and she said to me, "You know, in a little while, you're going to be interviewing an icon." She goes, "That's really cool." And you know what? I am interviewing an icon, and it is really cool. I've interviewed so many people, and I'm so glad that she's on because she's had a fascinating career. And she's an activist. She gets involved with. She just gets involved. She's what a successful person should be. She's a good role model, I think. And she has a new podcast I want to talk about. And my guest is Morgan Fairchild. How you doing, Morgan?
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm glad to have you on. I looked up. I want to hear about your podcast. So the first three episodes, very diverse guests. You had an influencer. You had a legend like you. You had someone in the political world. What, and you're doing it with your sister, who's an acting coach. What made you start a podcast?
You know, my sister and I grew up in the theater together. We started when we were little kids. And so we'd always worked together. But then in recent years, you know, as time goes on, we hadn't. And we realized we were losing touch because of our work schedules, because she teaches at night and I'm in LA and she's in Texas. And so during COVID, we just started making it a real priority to talk more. And so we started talking when she finished teaching on Sunday night. She would drive to her lake house about an hour and a half. We'd just have a good catch up every week. And then, you know, coming out of COVID, I started trying to think, what could we do together? What was something we could do together? Because we used to act together, but what could we do together? I thought, you know, everybody's doing these podcasts, so we should see about that and just talk about what we talk about, you know, on the drive home. So we started that and pulled it together. And then, you know, you're trying to come up with a good name, as I'm sure you know. And so, you know, everything was a little too cutesy or too bland or whatever. And finally, I just said, you know, really, it's just two bitches from Texas sitting around talking and trying to save the world. So that's how we came up with it. And so we just have very eclectic guests. So, you know, when we first started it, people were asking me, you know, what's your theme? And I said, you know, my theme is basically every friend I ever made in life is going to come on. and because I have very eclectic interests, it's an eclectic kind of show. We start off with Donna Mills and then my friend Tom Nichols, who's a Russia expert who taught at the Naval War College for 25 years and now writes for The Atlantic. And then one of my sister's students, who's a major influencer with 8.5 million followers. And, you know, of course, my first question being an old fuddy-duddy is, what the hell is an influencer and what do you do? And then we have John Edward the Psychic on and Stephen Tobolowsky, who's a wonderful character actor. And everybody knows from Groundhog Day, from Ned. And then my friend Norm Ornstein, who was at the American Enterprise Institute for years, decades, and is probably the foremost expert on Congress and voting rights in the United States. And then, you know, we had Linda Gray, Patrick Duffy, and right now our latest one, I think, is with my another one of my sister's students who she started teaching her when she was 14. And now she's out here. She's done When the Bow Breaks. Her name is Jess Sinclair. And she's on a show called Gen V, which is a spinoff of The Boys. So, you know, one of these hit shows for young people. So it's kind of a very diverse kind of group. We're doing next. We've got Love Boat people coming up and then George Conway. So it's all over the place.
It is great. Now, it's funny. You mentioned some people who have been in Hollywood for a long time like you. And I always talk to actors about this. When you've been in the industry for this long, how is it changing? So many people, so many actors I talk to say it's so different. So different now. You know, it's not the quotes gone. You know, back in the day, you could say, oh, here's my quote for the week when you're a guest star. Now it's like, we'll give you this. What have you noticed? Because you're on a soap, which one I'm talking about right now. You've been on TV. You've been on so many different TV shows. Your IMDb, you just look at it and you're like, wow. Like, you see just Kojak and then you see Happy Days and you see all this stuff. So how is Hollywood in your eyes?
Jack, Mork and Mindy, Friends, yeah. You know, it kind of runs the gamut there.
But how has Hollywood changed in your eyes right now as it runs?
You know, it's changed a lot since all the consolidations. First, the advent of cable, you know, because back when I was doing Flamingo Road and Falcon Crest, I think it was still, you know, three channels. And then, you know, so cable changed a lot. And then all these mergers have changed everything. So there's a lot less freedom, I think, for producers to just do what they want. There's a lot more people that have to sign off on everything. And, you know, things get watered down a lot, I think, when you have people, 15 people instead of two, that have to sign off on everything. Everybody puts their 2 cents worth in. So it's very, very, very different. Of course, now with streaming, it's totally different. And a lot of times people will say to me, well, but there's so much product, you guys must be doing great. But there may be a lot of product, but a lot of it isn't shooting in LA anymore. So it's very different here in town. But also, you know, a lot of times they don't want to pay anything. So to be frank, they don't want to pay anything. And so they don't want to necessarily pay name actors to come on. They'd rather have people that they can, as you said, take it or leave it kind of thing. So it just changed a lot over the decades I've been here. God, these many years. I've been here almost 50 years now. I can't believe I just said that.
It is amazing. The time does fly. I was in LA for 18 years and I've been back east for 8 years, but it just, you look at it and it just flies. I don't know if it's just it's just LA. You're always on the go. You're always like, for me, I was always, you have to worry, is it going to take 2 hours to go 6 miles, or is it going to take, you know, you have an audition and you go, I'm going to give myself an hour and a half to go to the audition. And then that day there's like no traffic from Burbank to wherever. And you're like, you're just sitting there going, well, I'm an hour early. What am I going to do? So it's just, LA is just so different. So, you're brought back a character from Bold and Beautiful, which is pretty amazing. You did this character, Dottie, what was it, 19 years ago? Tell me about how that happened and how you first started
Oh,
doing
maybe
it.
about 15 years ago. Yeah, they asked me to come on and do a little story arc for like 2, 3 days of this character. And then just recently they came back and said, we'd love to have you come back and do this. And so I did one episode with Jim J. Bullock, who's just wonderful, and we kind of team up on it. And then they had us come back and do a couple of more episodes. And I don't know when or if we'll do more. I have no clue. But they're terribly nice, and they've been very warm and welcoming, which is always nice. You know, when you're new on the show, no matter how long you've been in the business, it's always your first day on the set. And it's these people have been there for forever. Some of them really forever since the show started. You know, so it's always nice to have a warm welcome, and they're very nice over there. So it's appreciated.
Now, you said you've been in Hollywood for 50 years. What got you into acting? I know you're from Texas, and you said, and your sister acts too, so it's something that you both act. So there had to be something. Like for me, you know, my father was a good musician, my brother and my sister were good musicians. I stunk. So when I got out of college, I ended up getting into stand-up comedy because I learned how to make people laugh. But I think my whole family was, even though my parents were executives, they weren't. They were artsy underneath, and I think that helped me. But how did you end up getting, because both you and your sister are very accomplished in your fields. She teaches. And how did you, what made you start? What was your childhood like?
Well, my childhood was I was a little science nerd. I was one of those kids that teachers loved because I was always in advanced placement and made straight A's and never opened my mouth because I was incredibly shy, very quiet, very introverted. And my sister was always the big personality kid. But my shyness actually gave us both careers because, like I said, I was always the bookworm. But one teacher decided one year, she went in when I was in the 5th grade, that she wouldn't let us do written book reports, which I could do falling off a log. She wanted us to do oral book reports. And I couldn't talk. I mean, literally, I stood in front of the class for 3 days in a row and absolutely nothing would come out. So finally, my mother kind of walked me through that. But my mother comes from a family of debaters, and her brother was a lawyer and a judge. And, you know, it's like her father was a lawyer. And, you know, it's like, so you want to. She was damned if there were going to be, you know, I was going to be crippled by this shyness. So she enrolled us in what they call drama classes to bring me out. Well, but my sister enrolled too, and my sister loved it. And, you know, like I said, the big personality kid, she's the one with the Juilliard degree, you know, and she would love it every Saturday, and I'd be in the bathroom throwing up before we had to go to class. And, you know, you stood in front of class every week and you had to read something or recite something, a poem or something, and I absolutely hated it. But at the end of the year, they had us do a little play, and being the little fuddy-duddy that I was, they had me play the adult. And I thought, you know, this isn't too bad. This is kind of fun, you know, but I would never admit that. Anyway, one Saturday morning, my mother was reading the newspaper and she called us in and said, the Junior Players Guild are having auditions today and we should go. And the Junior Players Guild was this really wonderful children's theater group in Dallas. I'm not sure if it was there still, but it was there for 50 years and it was a wonderful, wonderful group and, you know, really did amazing productions. Anyway, so I knew we had to go because my sister said, I want to go, you know. She's always getting me in trouble. So we go and we sit in the back of the auditorium all day. And if you're a stand-up comic, you've probably done this. You watch everybody else do stuff. And, you know, we're watching all these kids do these little improvisations, you know, and in my mind, I'm thinking, I could do that well, you know, I could do that, you know, but I'm not gonna, I'm not going down there, you know. So finally my sister pipes up and says, I want to go audition, you know. So then I knew if I didn't go audition, I'd get yelled at all the way home. So we went down and auditioned, and this gentleman was kind enough to give us both little parts in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I was not a dwarf. You know, but I always say I only have a career today because my fear of the stage was second only to my fear of my mother. So getting yelled at all the way home. So he gave us a part, and that's, you know, that's where an adult can make a real difference in a kid's life by validating them. You know, I mean, if I hadn't gotten something, I was so shy, I probably would never have had the nerve to go back. But once an adult says, you have something, something small, something whatever, but there's a spark there, it gives you a little bit of confidence to try again, you know, to keep being encouraged to try again. So we kept going to auditions and kept working and working and working, and people kept giving us shows and stuff. And so, it, you know, about 15 or 16, then I, our mentor at the theater where we grew up, I kind of said one day, do you think I could do this for a living? And he gave me the best advice I always give young people, which is, if there is anything else in life you can do and be happy, do that. Because this business is, as you know, not a kind business, and especially to women. But people kept giving me work. I've been working since I was 10 years old. So kind of found a niche there. And I got married very young and had a husband and his mother to support. So I had to work. I had to get that job. It was a great motivator at the auditions. You know, I had to get that job.
Well, I think a lot of times in audition, true, if it's in your head, if you sit there, some people are very wishy-washy and they sit there and they're like, they just walk in and they don't take it serious. But if you sit there and if you're focused, I think people can tell, people can sense that, you know, it's not the desperation. It's just that feeling like I need this job. I want this job. And I think people can tell that a lot and they get impressed by it.
Well, you know, I when I first got out here to LA after all these other years of doing it, I had all these years of theater behind me. And you know, one producer told me I was auditioning for something, and one producer told me that when I walked in the room, I seemed so confident he wanted to punch me in the face. And he said, but then you walked out with the part. But what he doesn't know is that I'm not all that confident, but I learned how to fake it. So you learn how to act as if you are, you know, the hottest thing in town. And sometimes it works.
Now, do you remember what was your first TV or movie acting part where you had a speaking part? Because I always love to hear actors. I say this to musicians too. Like, when's the first time you heard yourself on the radio? And most people remember, what was your first, because you look on IMDb and there's a few other things like Kojak's down there, but what was your first part where you actually, you got lines and you were on TV?
I guess Search for Tomorrow. I mean, I had been doing commercials in Dallas and Runaway production, little movies. A lot of low-budget movies would come shoot in Texas because it's a right-to-work state. So I'd had a few parts. I can't remember if any of them had speaking lines or not. I did one with Fabian, Bullet for Pretty Boy, and right after Bonnie and Clyde. You know, everybody was doing gangster stuff. And I think I had a line, you know, but it was all very new. After you've been doing a lot of theater, doing camera is all very new. And that's where I was very grateful for Search for Tomorrow. Because even though I'd done a lot of commercials and I'd worked in front of camera a lot, I hadn't really done acting in front of a camera a lot. And so I would go in and watch the show every day on my lunch break instead of having lunch, I would go sit in the control room and watch the show. And I remember one day, one of the guys came by, one of my fellow actors, and said, "Why the hell are you watching our show?" You know, it's like I said, "Well, you know, I got married really young. I didn't get to go to college. I didn't, you know, I did night school and part time and things like that. And but if I'd gotten to go to SMU drama school, they would have put me on tape and play it back for me and show me everything I did wrong. And these people are paying me to do it." So I just sit there and watch every day and learn camera technique. Don't do that. Don't do that. Oh, don't do that. So I just kind of taught myself camera technique, and also going to every old revival movie theater in New York and watching double bills of every great movie ever done. You know, I learned camera technique from watching Marlene Dietrich and Marilyn Monroe and just, you know, how to move, you know, watching Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. You learn camera technique by watching other people and then trying it out yourself. And it's different than stage.
Now, how do you make the jump? You're doing the soap. How do you make the jump to Flamingo Road?
Well, I left the soap, number one, and moved out here because the soap was in New York. And so, and Kojak and some of the other things I was shooting, I was doing a lot of commercials at that point and everything, too. I moved out here and kept my apartment in New York like a smart little girl and, you know, see if I can make it out here. And I was so fortunate. You know, when you're young, you don't realize exactly how fortunate you are. I got out here May 20th of 77, and right after July 4th weekend, I had my first job. And it was with Patrick McGoohan, very intimidating actor, on a show called Rafferty. And I was so fortunate that the casting director, Ruben Cannon, had faith in me, because, as you know, it's always hard to get that first job. And even though I'd done all this theater and all this stuff in New York, when you move out here, it's like starting all over. And so he believed in me, and I was playing a blind ex-Peace Corps worker with my hair in a ponytail, thinking, oh, good, I can act now. I don't have to do all the glam stuff, you know. And so it was a real good thing to start with, to be on a show with such a well-known, intimidating actor from The Prisoner and all this stuff, you know, cult actor. And so got my foot in the door, and then started going on more auditions. And because I'd done a lot of theater, I could actually do comedy, which stood me in good stead. So suddenly I'm doing Happy Days and all these comedy shows, New Heart and everything. Because if they wanted a glamour girl who could do comedy, you know, I could be your blonde. So it was a learning experience. You know, you just, every job was a new thing. As you know, every time you pardon me, my nose is running a little bit. Every time you finish one job, you assume you're never going to work again. You know, so but I did. I kept working and working and working and working, you know, then got Flamingo Road after 2 or 3 years. But by then I'd already done a couple of mini series and a number of TV movies and things like that, and a ton of guest star stuff. So I had been doing quite a lot before I got Flamingo Road.
Well, that was like, to me, that was like the golden age of TV. Like, you know, you said, you know, some miniseries. And I remember as a younger kid watching, you know, Rich Man, Poor Man, you know, and it was, you would watch these shows, and you were in a North and South, you know, you would watch these shows where, and it was not like you would stream it. So you would sit there and you would watch it and you would be excited. I mean, I remember as a kid, Falconetti and Rich Man, Poor Man gave me nightmares. I'm like, oh my God, he's the meanest person ever.
Yeah.
And for you though, like you said, Happy Days and Mork and Mindy and, you know, all the, and then, you know, Flamingo Road and then Falcon Crest. It's like these shows were so big. And I think it's because there was only, as you said, three channels. In Philadelphia, we had 3, 6, 10, and the UHF channels that really had nothing. But what was the competition like back then? Because there wasn't as much work because there was only three channels.
Well, and there wasn't the amount of ancillary things either, you know, with cable and with streaming. There are just so many other shows. But back then, it was pretty much those three networks, whatever it was. If it was a TV special or a miniseries or whatever, it was those three networks. So those guys had to like you or you didn't work. But it was fun. It was great fun. You got to work with so many wonderful people. When I got out here, I was fortunate that, you know, the age I was when I got out here, a lot of the people I grew up watching were still alive and still working, some of them. And so you end up working, you know, with all these different people. I did the pilot of Hotel to have scenes with Bette Davis. I got to work with Vincent Price and his wife on a series they were doing. I got to do a miniseries with Natalie Wood and Roddy McDowell and, you know, and several things with Roddy over the years. Who became one of my best friends and, you know, just adored him. But you got to just work with everybody. And also, you know, you'd go out to some gala dinner for some charity and you'd be sitting between Jimmy Stewart and Olivia de Havilland and Robert Mitchum, you know. It's like, and all those people, they were great raconteurs, you know. They were generally very great storytellers. Esther Williams was hysterical. So... And just working with different people. I worked with Fernando Lamas as a director and as an actor. And, you know, when I got Flamingo Road here, I'm with Howard Duff and Barbara Rush and Stella Stevens and Kevin McCarthy. I called my sister and said, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I'm working with Kevin McCarthy, you know. And it was just great fun to actually get to work with people you had grown up watching.
So Falcon Crest you're on. And, you know, these shows, I said, these shows are, they're huge. I mean, they are huge. And so what is it like for you? Because you're a shy kid from Texas. Okay. As you said, if the right adult didn't say, give you a part, your career may have been, you don't know. So what is it like when the shy kid starts getting recognized everywhere and you're considered a bombshell and a sex symbol? I mean, you had posters, I believe. Didn't you have posters back then?
Oh, yeah, I think Farrah had the big one of the 70s, and I had one of the big ones of the 80s.
Because we would go to Spencer Gift, and you would go, and all the posters would be, you'd flip them, and there'd be like cars, football teams, you. I mean, so what is it like when all of a sudden all this attention is getting thrown on you? I mean, you seem very humble, and you probably were very gracious with it, but is it overwhelming? Was it overwhelming at times? Because as you said, and I said Falcon Crest, so many people watched it. And everyone, you know, would recognize you. What is that like for someone who's a shy person?
You know, you kind of learn to block it. You learn, first of all, where not to go, what time of day you can go do things, and when where not to go, where you're just gonna, you can't get through. And, you know, just you learn to change your life to kind of accommodate this new reality that kind of hits you in the face. It's like a bulldozer when it hits. And I was lucky because I had worked for so long and had worked my way up. So since 1973 with Search for Tomorrow, I couldn't go out without being recognized by certain crowds. And then doing the miniseries and doing all these other things. So when I got a series, it wasn't like a total change, except that it was. I mean, I didn't expect it to be a total change because I was already, you know, recognized a lot of places from different things. But suddenly to have that bulldozer hit, it was amazing. I had to hire a PR person to handle everything because I couldn't return all the calls every day. You know, it's like suddenly you are the new blonde and there are just not enough hours in the day to actually do the series and return everybody's phone calls. And so I hired Rodgers and Cowan in defense. Not to get me PR, to protect me from PR and tell me which ones I should do because you can't do them all.
Now, did you ever get those fans who are just annoying? I mean, back then, I mean, people, you know, it's changed now because with social media, everyone, you seem to know people more. You know, you can see them post, like you're very active in social media. You post your views and people know you. And you've always been an activist, as I said. You've always stood for a lot of good things. Back then, you know, people were sort of more elusive, you know, like they see you and they really didn't know anything about Morgan Fairchild. So, you know, what was it like? Did any people ever just bother you, like swarm you, that just made you feel uncomfortable?
Oh, yeah. People can be very scary. Crowds can be very scary. And so you kind of learn to just not get stopped. That's one of my favorite stories. I was doing a charity thing with Paul Newman in Vegas, and we were at Caesar's Palace. And because of the events for the charity, we had to get from one place across the casino to the other. And, you know, this is when I'm on the cover of everything and he is Paul Newman. So how are we going to get there? And without, you know, just boom, people just glomming onto you. And so Paul says, just watch me and do what I do. So we just kept the head down and got straight across. And we got over there and I said, what do we do? He said, well, he says, we have an element of surprise because nobody's expecting us to be here. Number two, we're both a lot shorter than people think we are. And he said, three, you keep your head down and you walk really fast. And by the time somebody says, you know who I thought that, you're gone. So that became the way I would get through a lot of stuff. And sometimes you go out, you know, kitchen doors, or you go out back doors, or you go down through the basement doors. You learn all the different ways you have to try to avoid crowds and avoid being seen at all. And I mean, it's weird though. Even now, when I wear a mask all the time because I'm a COVID person. I still wear my mask all the time. So I'm always amazed when people recognize me at the airport and, you know, just running around. People, aren't you Margaret Fairchild? I said, how could you tell? I said, your eyes. So, but it's you know, it's quite daunting when the crowd can get out of hand, and it's scary because people hurt you. I mean, people just come up, especially back then, they just come up and grab you. And I've had people throw me to the ground. They didn't mean to. They're just excited, like in an airport, and you're in heels and they just knock you over and stuff. I mean, hurt me. So it can be quite scary.
Now, you mentioned comedy earlier. I want to hear what it was like, first of all, being on Happy Days, because that was the show I loved. And then also working on Mork and Mindy, because they were both two, to me, very iconic shows that I watched all the time. And, you know, what was it like being on Happy Days? It was one episode, I think you did three of Mork and Mindy. What was it like just working with the Fonz and working with that whole set? It must have been pretty cool.
Oh, my God. To be out in California and have one of your early jobs be the new girlfriend for the Fonz in, like, 1977. I mean, how wonderful. How lucky can one girl get? And they were just wonderful. That whole set was just wonderful. Everybody was so nice. First of all, starting at the top with Gary Marshall, just a great mensch of a guy. And then Henry was a doll. All the guys, you know, I still see Anson and Donnie at all the autograph shows. In fact, Anson's going to do our podcast coming up. And you know, just everybody was just so nice. Marion Ross was a doll. Everybody was just great. And they all said, you know, when you're on the Paramount lot, come over and say hi, you know. So segue to one afternoon, I'm over there to say hi. I'm just had an audition or something. I stopped. And Henry says, hey, do you have to go anywhere? And I said, no. And he said, stay and watch our guest star work because he's amazing. So I stayed all afternoon and watched their guest star just so I could tell the guy he's a damn genius, you know. Anyway, like 6-8 months later, I get a call from William Morris. And, you know, it's like, oh, good news and bad news. What's the good news? Good news is you got the TV movie you wanted. Okay, what's the bad news? Well, Gary Marshall has this new show he's doing, and he wants you to do it. He loves you, but he doesn't want to pay you. He only wants to pay you top of show, and he won't give you a contract. He just wants recurring, but he won't even give a recurring contract. And you're making so much money than that now, we think you should just pass. So I said, what's the show? And he said, Mork and Mindy. And I said, that's Robin Williams' show. And he said, who's Robin Williams? There was a time. And I said, you know, Robin Williams is a genius. I saw him on Happy Days, that rehearsal. He's amazing. I said, don't tell Gary. I'd work for free to work with Robin Williams. So that's how I ended up on Happy Days, is because Gary liked my work. On the Mork and Mindy, because Gary liked my work on Happy Days. And so I was, you know, had this recurring character. It was 3 or 4 episodes that first year, you know, playing Mindy's high school girlfriend who's always trying to steal Mork away. And we had great fun. Robin was so much fun to work with.
Now, you also did Roseanne for 3 episodes where you played Sandra Bernhardt's girlfriend, I believe. What was that like? Because once again, sort of taboo back then, you know, being, you know, having two women involved. I mean, people bitch about it now, which still cracks me up. But back then, it was very different. So how did that come about?
Well, it was very iconoclastic at the time, which is one reason I wanted to do it. You know, they sent me the script and, you know, I read the script and through this whole thing, you know, Sandra's talking about her new girlfriend, and at the end of the episode, she opens the door, and it's Morgan Fairchild. I thought it was hysterical. So, which nobody would expect. Nobody would expect that. And I always like doing things people don't expect to see me do. I like doing things that are iconoclastic. And at that time, I think Ellen had come out, but this was maybe only the second time, you know, something like this had been done. And so, it was like 92, I think, or 92. Anyway, so I thought it was great fun. And it was fun working on it. But I like a challenge. I like to do and show up places where people don't expect me to. I don't like being stereotyped.
Well, that's always good for an actor. I mean, it makes you, you know, constantly work and makes you, as I said, iconic. Well, also, you did Pee-wee's movie. So, I mean, how did that come about? I mean, it's so funny when you sit there, it's like, you see, like, Murder, She Wrote, and then Pee-wee. And it's just, that's what you should be, that's something that, as an actor, I'd be so proud of, because you are so diverse. But how did Pee-wee's come about?
Well, I had met Paul. I'd hosted Night at the Improv. There used to be a half-hour show called Night at the Improv. And I was hosting it one week, and all the older comics had come in and run through their act. I think Shecky Green was one of them. It was all the older comics. And then this guy, younger guy, comes in at the end of the rehearsal and says, I'm not going to run through my act. I just stopped by to tell you, whatever happens tonight, I won't hurt you. And so I'm like, okay, what the hell is this guy going to do? Anyway, so he comes in that night. He's the last act. It's Pee Wee Herman. I've never seen Pee Wee Herman. I had no clue what was going on. He had a little brown paper bag full of plastic smiters and snakes that he was throwing at me. And we were having a great time bouncing around the stage. So after the show, he said, oh, you got me. You got me. Nobody ever gets me. And you just went with it. And I said, no, I grew up in the theater. We improvise. You know, so we became great friends. And we would go places together. And, you know, he was getting nominated for a lot of things. So he'd say, will you be my date for my, you know, for the gala, and I'll say sure. So I show up in, you know, some big bugle beat evening gown, and he shows up as Pee Wee Herman. So we're an odd couple. But so one day I get a call on my answering service, and they said, we have Pee Wee Herman on the line. And I said, okay, sure. So I got, and I said, Paul, I know your real name. You don't have to say it's Pee Wee Herman. So, you know. So he said, I have a favor. I said, yeah. He said, I've got my first movie. And I said, oh, great. Congratulations. And he said, yeah, but we have no budget. It's a shoestring budget, and we need some celebrity cameos, and everybody's turned us down. And I said, well, just wait, you know, don't tell people everybody's turned you down already. And we have no money. I said, I got the no money part, but when do you need me? And he said, Thursday. So I called over to Falcon Crest, and I got off on Thursday. I think only had one scene that day, so they moved in, and very kind. And I show up on the set, and it's Tim Burton's first movie. So Tim and Paul are in the back lot at Warner Brothers, which is kind of a forested area back then. They probably plowed it under now, but it was a forest back then, and they're doing the ninja fight. So I said, guys, listen, I've had 4.5 years of kung fu in Chinatown. I can do the ninja fight for you. But, you know, other than falling out of a tree, because if I break a leg, Falcon Crest is going to sue me. So we do the ninja fight, and then Jim Brolin arrives in his Pee-wee outfit. Now, I had done the pilot of Hotel with Jim a couple of years before, so I knew Jim. So here he is in this giant, because he's a big guy, you know, a big Pee-wee Herman. And I said, what are we doing? He says, I have no clue. So we had no script, we had no sides, we had nothing, we didn't know what we were doing. So the guys say, well, just look at you, each other, and Jim say, I know you are, but what am I? And we're like, but what does it mean? And they said, it doesn't matter. It'll be funny in the situation. In context, it'll be funny. And we have no clue. Again, no script, no sides. We have no idea what we're doing. So we do that a little bit. And then they say, okay, thank you. So I said, that's it? And they said, yeah, that's all we got. So I looked at Jim in his big Pee-wee costume. And I said, do you have to go back to work today? And he said, no, I got the whole day off. I said, so did I. You want to do more? And he said, yeah, what can we do? I said, I don't know. Let's go ask the guys. So we go over to Paul and Tim, and you know, I say, hey, guys, you got us for the day. You want to do something else with us? And you know, they said, what can we do? We don't have any money, and we don't have a set, and we borrowed the back lot here. We don't have it. What could we do? And so Jim, what a gent, he says, let me make a phone call. So he calls Aaron Spelling, and it so happened that the Hotel series filmed on the Warner Brothers lot, and they weren't shooting on the Fairmont set that day. So Aaron Spelling loans us the Fairmont lobby set. So suddenly you've got a scene where I'm a spy, and Jim's a big game hunter, and Pee-wee is a bellhop, and it's like paging Mr. Herman. And that's all just improvised, just with what we had.
See, that's
was the fun. That was the fun of making stuff like that. You know, you just go with it.
See, that's what's great. You know, that's stuff. That's how it is. It's so organic, and it turns out so great. Now, also, you were on Friends. What was that like? Because it was such a big show. And my friend Jamie Keller was on Friends a few times, and he said it was just, you know, it was after they had become so big that it was, you know, they were under that pressure because they just written, they'd been on the cover of magazines. So it changes the dynamic a little bit because everyone wants to know their business. But what was it like for you? And what was it like? I mean, you know, Matthew Perry, you know, everyone says what a comedic genius he was. I mean, what was it like? I mean, did they call you and say, Morgan, we want to do this part? Or did you say, you know, I want to be on that show? Or how did it all come about?
No, they just called and offered it to me. And the show wasn't a big hit yet. It was kind of muddling along. And they promoted it very heavily on my appearance. I always felt like, because the two Matthews grabbed me at a Blockbuster there on Ventura Boulevard, and, you know, they said, you got us in the top five, you got us in the top five. So, I always felt like I helped a little bit. But anyway, no, they called and offered it to me. And, I thought about it. And Cicely Tyson said, you're too young to play that guy's mother. You should pass, you know. And I said, no, I like the show. I've seen it. You know, it's cute. I think the kids are very talented individually. They're very good with their ensemble work, which coming from the theater, that's two different things. And so I said, no, I'm going to give it a shot. I think it has potential. I was right. So I show up that first day on the set. And I was like the first, I guess, celebrity guest star and the first parent that was on the show. Anyway, and so I show up and Matthew comes bounding over to me. As only Matthew could, all kind of big gangly, because he was a tall guy, and said, oh, you won't remember me, but I used to hang out with you on Flamingo Road in Falcon Crest with my dad. And I'm like, really? Who's your dad? No, John Bennett Perry, who had a recurring part as a sheriff on Flamingo Road at Falcon Crest. And I said, oh, my God, you're that little kid. And I'm like, yeah, now I'm thinking I could be old enough to be this kid's mother, you know, if he was hanging out with me on a series. But he was a real sweetie, and, you know, it's a very sad what happened. But, yeah, and then the show became a big hit, and it did, some of it changed. But they, you know, I always admired the way they all hung together and supported each other and hung in for negotiations and really were friends to each other. I think spoke very well of all of them about, you know, getting through that. Because, again, when the fame thing hits, and especially something like that, that is such a huge hit, I mean, it can really knock your teeth out, you know. So I think the fact that they all had each other and they were all going through it at the same time, and instead of isolating, they did seem to bind together to help and support each other, which I admire them for that.
Now, you in through your career, you've been involved with some very, you know, social issues and social matters. When did you start? As a kid, were you always someone who was very active and, you know, being involved in social and being in charities and stuff like that? Or as you got more famous and you knew you could make a difference, you started? Because I want to hear your path and some of the things you've supported in the past, because my wife's a sexual assault advocate. She was date raped 20 years ago, and she's been on TV a few times on different shows and, you know, things like that. And, you know, she really got into it, and she does it to really help people. She has, you know, people reach out to her a lot. You know, some girl from Israel was trying to create this app to, you know, prevent drugs and drinks. So hers came from an experience of what happened when, so she got into it, and she still does it, you know, not as much. But when did you start getting involved, and what was your first cause you really got behind?
You know, a lot of my activism is science-based because I wanted to be a doctor, a paleontologist, and so a lot of mine is science-based. So I started getting active. I was kind of active in New York, but there wasn't that much organized back in the 70s, you know, other than, you know, we'd all protested Vietnam and stuff, you know. So, I started getting active on pro-choice. Because I believe a woman should have a right to choose. And I was very big on global warming and climate crisis, again, because I'm a science nerd. And so I ended up doing a lot of, back in the 80s, initially it was the ozone layer. And so I'd been on a lot of daises with different people, including Al Gore. And we were the first people in D.C. that I know of that were talking about global warming back when he was still a senator. And he would lean over to me and say, you know, you and I are the only two people talking about this global warming thing. And I'd say, yeah, and we're the only two people listening. So, but I ended up testifying before a Senate committee in 87 and explaining the concept of global warming to them and working on that. So I've been an environmental activist. When Hollywood started getting around environmental issues in the 80s, Ed Begley Jr. and I were the two that everybody would want to sit down to dinner with and go over environmental issues and things like that and want us to get behind it. And then when AIDS came along, because one of my other weird hobbies is emerging viruses and epidemiology. And so I had been following this since I first saw like 18 lines or something of a paragraph, you know, that's like 13 clusters cases of Kaposi sarcoma in New York. And I thought, well, that's odd because that's a cancer you don't usually see in young people. It said they were young people. And then cluster cases in pneumocystis pneumonia in San Francisco. And I was, well, that's odd, because usually your body can fight that off. And then it came out that they were all in gay men. And then I knew something new was out there. And I started warning all my gay friends that something out there. And, you know, didn't have a name yet, you know. And so I was just tracking this virus. I like viruses. I am a weirdo. So I was tracking this virus. And then, you know, suddenly when Rock Hudson got sick, because I had been Rock State to a Lifetime Achievement Award like a few months before he went on Dynasty. And I was shooting Falcon Crest. And I remember, you know, word goes around on the lots that Rock isn't looking so great on Dynasty. And I knew immediately what it was. I mean, America didn't know Rock was gay, but everybody in Hollywood knew Rock was gay. So I knew what it was. but suddenly, you know, I'm being asked to be on Nightline and all these different shows to talk about AIDS, you know, which was just getting a name, because I was the only famous face they could have that could go on and explain what a retrovirus is and how it works and how you do and don't get it and things like that. And I was the only one willing to step up and do it. But that's the thing, because I knew I had this odd bit of knowledge because of my weirdo hobbies that a lot of people didn't have, including a lot of doctors didn't know much about it at the time. And I felt a moral obligation to step up and try to educate the public about the disease, protect the public, get rid of the stigma as a disease, but also the stigma on the gay community, get it just treated as a disease, and get research funding. So I testified before Congress to get AIDS research funding. And there for a few years, Dr. Fauci and C. Everett Koop, who was the Surgeon General at the time, we were kind of joined at the trying to get research funding and educate people and do everything. So it was a very scary time for people who weren't alive at that time. They won't realize how terrified people were of it, even in a weird way, more than COVID. At the height of the COVID pandemic, you know, shutdown and everything, people were terrified. I mean, and I lost friends. People didn't want me in their home. They didn't want me to eat up their plates. They didn't want me around their kids. And this was even before I started going to hospices, just because I was talking about it on television. I just, you know, you learn who your friends are. Because I'd explain to them, no, you're not going to get it from me. But you know, that people are weird. And you find out who the weird ones are who aren't really your friends. And I lost a lot of work because of it, and because I became controversial because I was talking about AIDS and trying to educate people. But, you know, but it was the best thing I ever did with my life, because I feel like I helped educate people. I helped get funding for research. Now there are people alive who are living with AIDS, and I like to feel that I had some small contribution to that. It was important. I felt it was important. It was bigger than me. It was important. And not some acting thing. This is just where my weirdo science stuff could actually help people.
Now, where do you think that came from to help people? Like you said, you lost work because of this. But for you, the cause is more important. Did that come from something instilled in you in your youth or something you learned? Because being very, you know, be forthright and supporting something, a lot of people don't. A lot of people, you know, I'm sure when you lost work, you lost a lot of money because you were very known, but you sat there and you made the choice. And that's, you know, we need more people like you that sit there and make the choice. But where do you think that came from? Did that come from something your parents instilled in you? Or is it just instinct where you're like, screw it. This is what I have to do. This is who I am.
Oh, honey, I'm so Aquarian. I always want to help everybody and I always want to save the world. So I am a big believer in empathy and sympathy, but also in doing the right thing. I couldn't have lived with myself if I knew that I had knowledge that could contribute to helping. Because at that time, a lot of doctors didn't know. I would do TV specials where the producer would come to me and say, you know more than these doctors you're interviewing. And I said, I know, but I just read about this. They've got other things to do, you know? I remember I was doing one Barbara Walters special. They had wanted to assign me to go up and visit the children's hospital in the Bronx. And I said, guys, that's what you always have celebrities do. And the producer knew me because he had produced Nightline at one time, too. And I said, you know, I'm a hard science person. Give me the hard science one. So they sent me down to St. Vincent's Hospital, where they were doing some protease inhibitors protocols. And this is about 30 years ago. And I was interviewing two guys who were gay, who had AIDS, who were doing the protease inhibitors. And so they were very nervous about being out and everything. But I, you know, I'm just a wise ass. So I'm laughing and joking with them. And then they loosened up and they were fine. And we did this interview and going back and forth with the doctors and everything. The producer came on one time when they were changing a battery and said, you know, when they assigned me to this segment with you, I was really upset. And she said, you know more than these doctors. You guys are speaking in acronyms. I can't even understand what you're talking about. And, you know, she said, I've got to hand it to you. I apologize that I misjudged you. but that was why, because at that time, a lot of people would just block out doctors and people were scared. And I knew that having a famous face and especially a sex symbol come on and say, you're going to have to change the ways you're having sex, guys. It's like, it's different than a doctor or some goody two shoes or something that people felt they knew me and knew me playing good bitches and very heightened sexual people. I knew it would be different coming from me. And I remember the first time I was going to go visit a hospice and I was very nervous. Obviously, if you're in hospice, you know you're dying. And I didn't know what to say to these guys. You know, what am I going to say? And I got there and the first three of them immediately grabbed me and said, we want you to show us your eye makeup secrets. So I found that I could lighten the load a bit. I could make people feel seen. I could make people feel, because everybody got abandoned. So many people were abandoned by their families, by their lovers, by their friends, that you could make people feel seen. You could give them their dignity back. You could give them face. You could give them a sense of who they were again and that they were loved and valued as a person, as a human being, and not just this crazy disease. And try to educate other people so they didn't get it. That was part of it.
See, that's awesome. That's so good. Now, I want to go back to your podcast. You mentioned Steve Matobolowski, and he's done my show twice, and he is such an amazing, amazing storyteller. And just talking to you, I can tell you're an amazing storyteller. Give me a good story. Because you probably have tons of them, but I know you talked about the Mark and Mindy and the Pee Wee Herman. I want to hear a good story from Morgan Fairchild.
Oh, Jesus. Like any genre you want to hear?
Hollywood story. Something Hollywood. Maybe someone that you met that you couldn't believe you would meet.
Well, my big idol was Rudolf Nureyev, who was the greatest ballet dancer in the world. But you know, one time, I'll give you one. One time I was doing a Bob Hope special. And Bob had gotten Jack Lemmon to be on it. And Jack was playing the piano and all that. We were shooting in Austin, Texas, at the University of Texas. Anyway, we finished rehearsal at night, and we come back. I'm still in my costume. I've got this strapless blue sequin number on. And we come back, and Bob says, you know, Jack and Morgan, I am the spokesman for this bank group here, and they're having their convention upstairs. Would you just come up and say hi to everybody? You know, so we say, sure. So we go up to say hi to everybody, who are pretty much plots by the time we get up there. And so one old guy grabs me and pulls me out on the dance floor and, you know, kind of stepping all over me and trying to put his hand on the front of my strapless gown. At which point Jack Lemmon comes and grabs the other arm and twirls me away and says, "Unhand that woman, sir." And I'm rescued by Jack Lemmon. And then one day we were in the bar for some reason, I forget, because I don't drink, but my mom was there because she's from Texas, and she had done Good Morning America or something a couple of months before with Farrah Fawcett's mother, you know, the two blondes from Texas. And so anyway, so my mom's there, we're sitting at the banquet in the bar, we've got Jack Lemmon, Bob Hope, maybe Larry Gatlin, my mom. Anyway, we're sitting there, and this woman across the bar just, "I know you." And we're all looking at each other, and she comes right over to my mother and says, "I saw you on Good Morning America." And Jack says, "What am I, chopped liver?" Anyway, that's a couple of stories.
So what are your plans for the next few years? You're doing the podcast. You may be back on Bold and the Beautiful. Do you pursue acting as much, or is it something that you do it when a role comes up? Or what do you look in your career? Because you've done so much. I always think when you've done, I mean, you've done so much. And it's like, you know, and you still, I'm sure you still love it, because they say, you know, actors, comedians, musicians never get out of it. Even like when I left the business, I end up coming back in it because it's in our blood. But what are your plans for like the next 2 years?
Well, you know, the one thing I learned very early on, when you sign up to be an actor, you are a gypsy for life. And so I never make plans, because plans never go the way you want. Right now I'm working on the podcast like this, and I do... you know, I work. I just did a little movie in Florida and a little indie movie. And then this last weekend, I was down in Palm Springs doing a seated reading of a play that a friend of mine wrote. My friend Luke Yankee, his mother was Eileen Heckert, who was an amazing, brilliant character actress who won an Oscar for Butterflies Are Free and won Emmys and, you know, Lifetime Achievement Tony, big Broadway star. But she happened to do a movie called Bus Stop with Marilyn Monroe, where she played her best friend. And so Luke, who wasn't even born at that time, has written a play about the way that friendship affected his mother, who was kind of a hard, tough lady, and him, because of the way it affected her, affected him and their relationship. And it's an interesting play, and he called, and it's been getting good reviews around the Southland here. But anyway, they were doing a staged reading, and so he asked me to play his mother. And I looked nothing like his mother, but I love acting, and I really liked the script. I liked it a lot, and so I said yes. So we did it this weekend, and again, it was just really great to get that feedback from a live audience, because it's a real acting stretch for me to play his mother, to play Eileen Heckert. And I was very touched, because some people who had come to see it actually had known his mother. I actually met his mother briefly when he directed me in a play 25 years ago in New York. She came to opening night, and I met her briefly, you know, kind of awestruck, because she's a big Broadway star and everything, Oscar winner. But to play his mother... And people came and said, "My God," you know, when Morgan walked out, I thought, how's she going to play Eileen? And then the voice, and then the whole, he said, "She was your mother. She was your mother." And it's a tough role, you know, because she was a tough lady. And I was talking to Luke about it, and he said, you know, sometimes actresses have a hard time playing her because, you know, they just don't want to be such a bitch. I said, "No, I've played bitches my whole career. I don't mind." And I said, "The one thing about me that's different than other actors, I don't need you to love me. I don't need you to love me. I don't mind being the bad guy." So I was very proud of that. You know, just as an actor, it felt really good to be in front of a live audience, and it felt really good to get feedback, and felt like it went well. You know, so yeah, it never gets out of our blood. You never lose that. It's always there. And so I'm always looking for parts, always looking for things to do, and, you know, looking for ways to be creative, a la the podcast, finding new things to do, things that people don't expect you to do.
Well, that's awesome. I always end my show with this question. Looking back at your career and your life, and this can be professional, personal, and you already hit on it a little bit, but what makes you really proud? I mean, besides the work, because we know that the AIDS work, I can tell you lit up when you talk about that it meant so much to you. But what are some other things that make you proud? Because people, you know, I've had actors say that I've acted and paid my kids through college. There's all different answers. But what makes you proud about the life you have lived?
Well, I've taken on challenges, artistically and personally. I'm very proud of the AIDS work because it was tough and I did lose work on it. I knew I would lose work. I didn't know I'd lose as much work as I did, but I did know. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that I always try to take on projects that scare me. Like this last weekend, trying to play Eileen scared me, and that's why I thought I needed to really tackle it. I try, and again, just doing iconoclastic things like the lipstick lesbian thing on Roseanne, where people don't expect to see you. I don't like people to pigeonhole me. I did a tour of The Graduate and did Mrs. Robinson. That was a fun thing. I guess the thing I'm proudest of is that I've had the guts to stand up for things I believe in, and whether it's voting rights or environmental issues or pro-choice or AIDS or now COVID, because I try to educate people on COVID with my social media things, because COVID is not over and COVID wrecks your life. I have a lot of friends now with, I have three friends with breast cancer from it, one waiting for a kidney transplant. My fiance died of heart attacks from it. I have a lot of friends with long COVID with real problems functioning. And because I'm an advocate, again, because of virus stuff, because I'm an advocate, I have a lot of Twitter followers or ex followers for COVID. And it's a very disabling disease that is kind of being overlooked and forgotten. So I'm still trying to educate people. But I think the thing I guess I'm proudest of is just having the guts to stand up for things that I know will hurt me.
Well, this has been awesome, Morgan. I'm so glad we got to talk. Hal, tell us where we can find your podcast. How can everyone find you? Where are we going? Where are we going with this?
Oh, anywhere, YouTube, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts, you can find Two Bitches from Texas and my sister and me being silly with a lot of different kinds of people.
So people,
But thank you. Thanks for the plug.
people, go check out the podcast. Go on IMDb and go watch her. Go watch the Pee Wee Herman movie again. Go watch her work. Also go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 1,059 episodes there. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Also, if you go on YouTube, look up Lawsuits and Lessons, myself and John Fagerholm, an attorney I knew in L.A. He lives in L.A. and Texas, both. We interview top entrepreneurs every 2 weeks. It's really good if you're a business person. John knows some amazing people. I know some great entrepreneurs from the Philadelphia area. So go check that out. And yeah, and that's about it. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.